the Buddha, which is the Dharma, which is the Sangha. I've just done a number of talks on Rumessa's Kyoto Kaiman commentary as part of a series of talks on how to grow a lotus blossom. I want to do a few kind of wrap-up observations, make a few wrap-up observations today about the precepts and the refuges in particular. I don't remember when it was after 76, but it was not too long afterwards, within a few years, I think. The Rim Master, you know, was always continuing her training, came up with another incredibly concise way of stating the three refuges. And she put this on the back of the Raksu, the lay ministers, I believe. Didn't she? I take refuge in the eternal. Is that true? I take refuge in that which the eternal teaches. I take refuge in those who know the eternal. Was that put on the back of the lay ministers' Raksus at some point? Oh, the monks have them. Well, anyway, they went on the back of some Raksus, and ever since, for me, this has been the most perfect expression of the three refuges that I personally, you know, for me personally, I'm not saying this is for everyone, but for me personally, I take refuge in the eternal. I take refuge in what the Buddha is at the deepest level. I take refuge in that which the eternal teaches. Therefore, in my daily life, I wish to listen. In order to be, I wish to be still and to listen, to be, have an open heart turned towards the eternal in order to hear that which the eternal teaches. I take refuge in those who know the eternal. That in actual daily life, you know, when you need help from another human being, the best help you can get is from someone who knows the eternal. Now, River Master always emphasized the importance of cultivating a kaleidoscopic mind. And a kaleidoscopic mind recognizes there are many ways of expressing many points of view that have truth, and some that have deep truth. So it's important to understand that this particular way of expressing the three refuges is not an exclusive way of expressing it. And nowhere is that more true than in the way it describes the Sangha treasure. In actual, for actual, you know, practical purposes, you know, it's really helpful to go for refuge to those who truly know the eternal. And that's that should be kind of obvious. If your need is a spiritual need and you need human help, it's best to go to people who are plugged into the eternal. And this is not an exclusive meaning. So at any particular time, any of us may be a bit, or sometimes more than a bit, out of harmony with the eternal. Maybe a karmic cloud is passing through and we're confused. Maybe a big wad of pain is coming up and it's all we can do to cope with that, and we're a little off center because of it. You know, who knows? But you can't take anything too far. And this, I take refuge in those who know the eternal. It's incredibly helpful. It's, you know, my personal favorite way of expressing the Sangha refuge, and it is not exclusive, and it can't be pushed too far. Or pretty soon, you turn into, you know, the Puritans. You know, you have some kind of test. Does this person know the eternal? If not, well, you're no longer in the Sangha. You're not the Sangha treasure. You know, you can't go that way. As a general rule of thumb, I'd like to propose a principle. I can say who is the Sangha treasure for me. I cannot say who is not. Because after all, in what human being, in what being, is there an incapacity to know the eternal? There is no such thing as an absolute incapacity to know the eternal. All beings possess the Buddha nature. All beings long to return to their true home, whether they really know that or not. All beings long to be loved, to know love, and to give love. Even if at times we are blind to the true source of love, which is the eternal. So I can say who at this moment is a Sangha refuge for me if I need advice, if I need help. And I cannot say that anyone else is not that Sangha refuge. Therefore, you know, there is no excommunication whereby the Sangha or someone representing the Sangha somehow determines that some being is out of touch with the eternal and therefore says they are forever out of touch with the Sangha. The most in Buddhism you can do is if someone is doing something that you personally do not wish to join in with, the most you can do is just go sit somewhere else until sanity sets in, so to speak. And you still cannot say this person is not the Sangha treasure. I cannot. Maybe someone can. I cannot. No one is excluded from the love of man or the love of God. No one is excluded from the love of man and the love of God. No one is excluded from the love of God and the love of man. No one is excluded from infinite love. And what we call the Sangha is an expression of that infinite love. It's important that in our own minds and our own hearts, we do not sully or tear the golden body of the Sangha. Even while at times we have to sit apart. And if it is our true and sincere intention not to do a tearing or a sullying, then the Eternal will help us with that. If we do our part, the Eternal will help us with that. And for certain practical purposes, sometimes we have to sit apart. Reverend Master used to say, when the Buddha taught, the unbelievers were allowed to depart. The unbelievers were allowed to depart. The unbelievers were not damned. The unbelievers were allowed to depart. When there was serious trouble among his disciples, sometimes the Buddha would go sit elsewhere until they cottoned on to what they were doing. He did not say, you are damned and excluded from the grace of God, from salvation, from enlightenment. He just sat by himself until people settled down and came and said, will you please come sit back, you know, sit with us again. With regard to the treasure of the Dharma, the same general principle is true that I've just said about the treasure of the Sangha, that this is not an exclusive meaning. It is possible for all beings to hear the voice of the Lord of the House, to hear the teaching of the voice of the House, if they really wish to do so, the Lord of the House, if they really wish to do it. And there's not just one means by which this teaching comes. The teaching can come from a book, from what someone else says. A teaching can come directly from one's own heart. So obviously it's not an exclusive meaning. And again, in the most practical sense of how we live our daily lives, which is really what Buddhism is about, where the focus is in our daily lives, the deepest teachings point us to the primary importance of listening to the eternal, of waiting upon the teaching that comes from the eternal, of following that teaching when it comes. The precepts start flashing when a particular precept will start flashing when we're starting to wander off from that focus. Then that precept lights up. The Eternal uses the precepts, uses our taking the preceptual truth to heart, to help us reharmonize with itself. Not long before she died, Rinpoche Master told me, in order to have the highest realization, you need to have the highest practice and the highest teaching together. Now, what is the highest practice? The highest practice is meditation and the path of preceptual truth, bringing one's life into harmony with the eternal through taking the true spirit of the precepts to heart, through asking, offering, waiting, and listening to the eternal, and following. That's the highest practice. And to do that practice, we need the teaching that goes with it. One cannot say other teachings are not the Dharma, just as one cannot say that someone is not in the Sangha. And in order to have the highest realization, in order to harmonize fully with the eternal, we need the highest practice and the highest teaching, the teaching that goes with the highest practice. If the teaching begins to slip, practice will inevitably follow. Inevitably. I never heard Rinpoche Master say what she said to me there, before. I don't know who else she said it to, but I know that for me, that's one of the most important things she ever said to me. In order to have the highest realization, you need both the highest practice and the highest teaching. When I began these talks, I believe that I talked a little bit about the fact that I believe that the teaching that is expressed in how to grow lotus blossom is the teaching that came through Reverend Master from the Eternal for all of us who follow in her footsteps and who wish like her to know the perfection, to realize the perfection of Zen. Reverend Master used to say, again and again I've heard her say, you know, I found what is true for me. And I'll just say that so far in my life, so far in my training, I continue to find that what Reverend Master taught in how to grow lotus blossom, what was expressed there, what came through her at that time, I continue to find that to be true for me in my own experience. There are certain aspects of it that I have not yet experienced, and I don't know if I ever will. And that doesn't concern me. It's not a problem. Enough of it has been proved true, and some of it with incredible precision, that I just trust about the rest and figure, well, that's in the hands of the Eternal, isn't it? Not my problem. Of course, everyone experiences these things in their own way, as she herself points out. And there are certain basic steps, fundamental steps, that none of us can avoid if we're going to undergo the conversion process, the conversion of greed, hate, and delusion into compassion, love, and wisdom, if we're going to reharmonize with our own true nature. Another thing that I find in her teaching is that it is simply a tremendous confirmation of what the Buddha himself taught. There's nothing original in it, except that there's an original expression there because it's her experience, not someone else's. And yet, it is all a great confirmation of what the Buddha himself taught and what all the Buddhas and ancestors have taught, what is in the scriptures. In the beginning, one simply has to trust one master's teaching. Later on, it's more than trust. One simply knows, this is true for me too. This is a description of the treasure that is my treasure and her treasure and potentially the treasure of all beings. One word that one doesn't say that I haven't sometimes associated real closely with the precepts is simply the word love. But, you know, what are the precepts really about but about love? And what is the love that the precepts are about? the precepts are about what is in truth most precious to each of us. The precepts are about what is most precious to us. The precepts are about what we can potentially when we've really got spiritually on track, what we can potentially experience of love and know of love at its deepest level, in its finest, most magnificent form. The precepts are about our loving the eternal more than anything, and our coming to know that we are loved in a way that is simply incomprehensible, and that has nothing to do with our seeming virtue or lack of it. It has nothing to do with any external thing. It is just an infinite love that cannot help but love that which is of itself. The precepts are about our not doing that which blinds us to this reality that we are born within, that we live within, that we suffer within, that we do both foolish and wise things within, that our very life is a swimming within this love, and that due to causes and conditions we have to awaken to. That we can awaken to. Sometimes people who do not really yet know this love very fully think that if they were to love the eternal more, they would love man less. But of course that's not true. Love can't be divided. Love can't be cut up into lumps. The love of the eternal is. In the Tenzo Kyokan, the instructions to the chief cook, Dogen speaks about the cook caring for the food as if it was his own eyesight. Well, why would someone do this? Well, the answer is, well, if you know this love, why would you not do this? If all things are of the eternal, if one has seen Buddha in all things, why would not one act accordingly? When we bow to one another, when we make a show to one another, what is it that we are recognizing? The Buddha in another. Dogen's master said that within the Sangha, people are closer to one another than most people are to themselves. Why is this so? Only because we are training in a way that opens our eyes to the love that is the reality of all things. Most of the time, we're not particularly focused on that fact. Why should we? We've got our lives to live. We've got our responsibilities. And yet gradually, we come to know that this love is the kind of cosmic background of everything. And that whether we're aware of it at any particular moment or not, it is supporting us, helping us, sustaining us. When we come to die, we can relax into it and trust it completely. And it will look after us. How is it that the precepts are about this? How could they not be about this? What would be the point of them without this? Without this, why should a virtuous life be any different from a vicious life? Why bother? You know, we do the hard work of training in the precepts beyond all concerns about virtue and vice, right and wrong, good and evil. Because to live in a way that is true to our own true nature is the only true good in life. And that true nature can never for a moment, is never for a moment, separable from its infinite love. Buddha, Siddhartha.